All right. I didn't have a chance to set up the PowerPoint. I only had a couple pictures that I thought might be interesting, but hopefully we'll be able to make these things clear as we go on. All right. We are in Mark chapter 2. We just talked about the fact that Jesus was eating with tax collectors and sinners in verses 13 through 17. And now we're going to have some, Jesus is going to field some questions about fasting in verses 18 through 22. And it would seem that as we are following what's going on here, that perhaps the eating with tax collectors and sinners was happening right before this question on fasting. We see it happening in this particular sequence in Luke. We also see it in this sequence in Matthew, I believe. And so we see that perhaps they're seeing these people eating, and it's on a day that they typically fast. Why aren't your disciples fasting? So let's go ahead and read this, verses 18 through 22. Somebody please read.
Now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting, and people came and said to him, "Why do John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees fast, but your disciples do not fast?" And Jesus said to them, "Can the wedding guests fast while the bridegroom is with them? As long as they have the bridegroom with them, they cannot fast. The days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day. No one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment. If he does, the patch tears away from it, the new from the old, and a worse tear is made. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins. If he does, the wine will burst the skins, and the wine is destroyed, and so are the skins. But new wine is for fresh wineskins."
Okay. All right, so the Pharisees and the disciples of John are here. They were fasting, it says. And it says the Pharisees were pretty much known for fasting. In Luke 18, verses 11 through 12, do you remember what was happening there, what Jesus was talking about? We can turn there real quick, and we'll see what Jesus says there. Well, Jesus is quoting a Pharisee, so it's not Jesus. Well, yeah. Luke 18, 11 through 12. 11 and 12.
The Pharisees stood and prayed thus with himself, "God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week, and I give tithes of all that I possess."
All right, so if you remember this particular event or this story that Jesus tells, whether it's an event or not, hard to say, but he's comparing a Pharisee going before God and a tax collector going before God. And the Pharisee, what's the Pharisee doing? He's bragging about all the things that he does, right? He's so high and mighty. Holier than thou, as it were, but in an unjust way. And at some point, he says, "I fast twice a week." And according to the Mishnah, which is the oral tradition of the Jews at this time, of course, this one was recorded a few hundred years later, but it could still relate to what we're seeing here. They fasted on Mondays and Thursdays. Those were their typical fast days. Fast twice a week. That's what we see in Luke 18. And oftentimes, or at least Jesus chastised them in Matthew chapter 6, verse 16. Do you remember what that says is the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 6:16. Do you have it, Sam?
Yeah. Moreover, when you fast, do not be like the hypocrites with a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces that they may appear to men to be fasting. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward.
All right. So, Jesus is chastising hypocrites who are making, again, a big show of their fasting. They disfigure their faces. They make themselves... it's obvious that they're fasting, and it shouldn't be that way. They're showing off, right? Their piety. And, of course, in that sense, they have their reward. But even so, maybe there were some Pharisees who were doing so in a righteous way, but they did so on the on twice a week and potentially on Mondays and Thursdays. But at the same time, we also see that John's disciples are involved here. but before we get there, I do have up there Leviticus 16:29-31. This was the only event where fasting is commanded in the Old Testament. So fasting there, we have different examples of fasting in the scriptures. You know, Daniel fasted, Esther fasted, Moses and Elijah, they fasted for a while. We see examples of that in the Old Testament, but the only command that's given is in Leviticus 29-31. If you look at that, it says in the New King James, and you will afflict your souls, which is kind of an interesting way of wording that. According to some other readings of that, that's another way of saying that they will fast. So, in fact, I have that on my footnotes. It says in my Bible, afflict your souls, and then a footnote says, and they will fast. So fasting during the time of the Day of Atonement was very likely what was talked about there, and the only time that it was commanded. But, so why would they fast? Why did Daniel fast? Why did Esther fast? Moses, Elijah? Why fast?
Well, it tends to focus your mind.
Focuses your mind? Okay. It also is a way of being... It is a way, if you do it right, it's a way of being more pious, more godly. We talked about that last week a little bit, at least godliness. And it's a way to be closer to God. Now you wonder, how can denying myself of food bring me closer to God? You know, you might be surprised in how it does that. Because instead of just denying yourself of food, while you're doing so, you're praying. And you're afflicting yourself personally on purpose, so that your own devotion can get stronger and you can get closer to Him. So that's a reason why they fasted. We see different fastings that we see in the Old Testament. Esther, she fasted because she was hoping for a particular outcome. Daniel fasted for a similar reason. Moses and Elijah, Moses fasted. One of the reasons was so that the people could be forgiven of some of their sins. Elijah, I think his fast was more of a fast of circumstance. But they were allowed to, they did so, and they were brought a little closer to God, or at least they felt as such. All right. It also, yes?
You may have mentioned this last week when I was in teaching a class, but the other aspect of fasting is denying the physical and focusing on the spiritual.
Yes.
When you say, okay, sure, my body wants this, but I'm going to focus on this instead.
Yes.
Something else. You also have the notion of sacrifice in general, where you're saying, I'm not going to worry about my next meal because God's going to provide.
Right.
And so there's an aspect of that in there too.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot of good and positive reasons to fast. Again, if you're I've talked about it before. Just happens to come up in our study today. If you're healthy, I recommend it. If not, don't do it. You know, we don't want you to hurt yourself or harm your health in any way. All right, so we also note that the disciples of John fasted as well. Now, it's unclear when they fasted, whether it was the same time as the Pharisees or not. Could have been. It's a sort of an odd team up, don't you think, though? I mean, John, at this point, we understand he's in prison. He was already, so, but his disciples are still going about. What did John have to say to the Pharisees? Do you remember? He called them a brood of vipers. That's right. That's exactly right. He called them a brood of vipers. So it'd be kind of an odd thing for them to team up, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It doesn't say they were fasting together.
But what we see a couple different things. It's possible that the Pharisees went to John's disciples and are like, you know, you and I are fasting. Why aren't these folks fasting? And so the disciples of John are like, hey, yeah, that's right. Why aren't they fasting? And so they decided to ask Jesus' disciples or Jesus about this. You know, it's not a bad thing to ask this question necessarily, but it is something that may be concerning the disciples of John. All right, so at the very least, it was considered unusual for the disciples not to fast at this time. You know, one of the things that I thought interesting as I was reading this, they asked, why don't your disciples fast? They never ask, why don't you fast? I found that kind of interesting. Why didn't they ask him that question? I don't have an answer, it's just a thought. Maybe they thought that, you know, the disciples are the ones who need to be fasting and not necessarily the teachers. I'm not sure. I don't know.
It's a good practice as far as disciplining yourself to do without something. It could be something else as well as food.
Yeah.
But I've been told that fasting actually gives your body a chance to cleanse itself. And I don't know enough about it to know whether that's anything to it or not. But I know the more you think positive that you have control of what you do, you don't have to live with the refrigerator door open. You know, like I do. That's possible to overcome.
Right. Yeah.
It's good for you to do that, to overcome it.
And if you can overcome your hunger pangs, perhaps you can also overcome other temptations that you might have. And so that really helps with that as well. You know, we did talk about this a little bit when we talked about Jesus in the wilderness for 40 days. It doesn't mention in Mark that he fasted, but we understand. I don't think it did. But we do see that it did mention it. Okay. but at the very least, it certainly mentioned it in Matthew and Luke. All right. All right, so this particular thing, it doesn't mean that John's disciples agreed with the Pharisees on everything, but at least on this one thing, they have this shared, this common practice.
quick question.
Sure.
They refer to the Pharisees all the time. Now, was that like a Hebrew priesthood or club or a covenant, or who were these guys?
So there were several different sects that they had in Jerusalem or in Israel at that time. At least four major ones, perhaps some minor ones as well. Two of them are really talked about a lot in Scripture, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So they're kind of like denominations, but not quite.
Kind of like political parties, too. I mean, it's all mixed up because the rulers were the head of the religious groups. And
they mentioned the Herodians as well. That's more of a political party, not necessarily a...
The Zealots would be another one.
Yeah, the Zealots would be another sect. But the Essenes is another one that's not mentioned in the New Testament, but they were around at the time. They were a little bit more minor. But But the Pharisees had a certain way of thinking about scriptures. And the interesting thing about it, they were right most of the time. They were just wrong in execution. One of the fun things we'll see later on, I don't want to get into that now. That's a rabbit I don't want to chase at the moment. But the Pharisees were, Paul was a Pharisee before he became a Christian. We see Joseph of Arimathea was a Pharisee, the one who lent his tomb to Jesus for his burial. Nicodemus, we see in the book of John, was a Pharisee. So there were some Pharisees who were good men, but overall as a group, they were hypocritical. They were doing things for show rather than for the merits that they had. Of course, at some point they often put their tradition over the law, which we'll see later in chapter 7 of Mark.
Was there authority? And they did have some authority. Was it based in the law, or were they hooked up to the local government?
Well, they had the Sanhedrin, the council at the time, which is the elders, which is kind of taken from the law, where Moses set up some elders over the people. And so they kind of took that and said, let's set up the Sanhedrin, the council, the elders in this way, and a good number of them are Pharisees and a good number of them are Sadducees. And we see that especially in Acts, 23, or 24, where Paul is before them and causes a division between the Pharisees and Sadducees. So they do take that to some extent. Another passage, Matthew 23, the first few verses, where Jesus is chastising the Pharisees all over the place. The first few verses, he says, that they sit in the seat of Moses. So you do what they say, not necessarily what they do. Because they say a lot of good things, but they don't necessarily practice what they preach. And so they did have some authority in that way.
Except parable would be like in modern times, you've got Catholics, you've got Presbyterians, you've got Episcopalians. So Pharisees might be a group like one of those.
Again, they're not exactly like denominations, but they're similar.
Yeah. There's enough similarity. Like the Pharisees and the Sadducees had really different views on Scripture. The Sadducees really only cared for the first 5 books, and the Pharisees looked at all the rest of the prophets. And like it says later, the Pharisees believed in angels and spirits, and the Sadducees didn't believe in resurrection. So they were really different religious schools of thought.
Yeah.
And in that sense, they're like denominations, but they didn't really think of them as denominations as much.
Yeah, as strict divisions like we do today. Yeah. All right. So it'd be almost like in Catholicism, they have... No, I don't want to get into that. That's too much.
You teach whole classes on that, too.
I know. All right. So Jesus uses 3 illustrations here to... Basically, the point of these illustrations is to show that it's not entirely appropriate for his followers to fast at this time. So the first 2 verses of these illustrations, verses 19 and 20, all refer to this same thing, to a wedding feast. So wedding celebrations, you might know about this, but they lasted a week in their culture. And in fact, I think they might still do in some modern Jewish circles. But a week of feasting, of celebration, of the union of 2 people. Man, that's a fantastic thing. They're having a great time. It's a happy occasion. And in this particular illustration, Jesus, he's likening his disciples to the friends of the bridegroom. And this is a similar phrase used in John 3:29. And somebody turn there. Let's look at John 3:29.
Can you imagine what it would be like if you had several weddings and within a week, somewhere, 3 weeks, and all the feasting that would go on?
Almost like Thanksgiving and Christmas, back to back.
John 3:29.
Yes, ma'am.
He who has the bride is the bridegroom. But the friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, his joy of mine is fulfilled. This joy of mine is fulfilled.
All right, so who's speaking here? That's John the Baptist, right? John the Baptist is speaking here. And he says he's the friend of the bridegroom. This is, in our modern way of having weddings, John the Baptist was kind of like the best man in this particular wedding situation. And so the friends of the bridegroom, as we see in this passage, suggests that the disciples would be the groomsmen. So they are in the wedding party, and they're enjoying this happy time, this not a week-long wedding feast, but essentially a three-and-a-half-year wedding feast that's going on here at this time. And it's just such a happy occasion. Jesus himself likens himself to the bridegroom. Who's the bride?
The church.
The church. That's right. The church is his bride. All right. So it's such a joyful time. And at any kind of wedding, if a Pharisee is at a wedding for a week, you reckon he's going to fast on Monday and Thursday? No, he's going to be feasting, not fasting. He's going to be enjoying himself during that time. If he's part of the wedding party, man, he's going to be enjoying that. And so Jesus is saying this is not appropriate. This is a wedding feast, essentially, that we're engaged in. We're having, this is a joyful time for us to be here. And oftentimes, fasting is linked with mourning, almost, because we do see that whenever someone undergoes some kind of sorrow or grief, then they might fast for a while as well. We see David doing that as he was praying for one of his sons to survive, one of his infant sons to survive, but he did not. But he still wanted to fast to help with that. All right. And this is the first time in verse 20. For the days will come when the bridegroom will be taken away from them, and then they will fast in those days, or in that day. Jesus, he's alluding to his death for the first time, at least in the Gospel of Mark. And at least in Mark, this is the only time he does so before he is on his way to Jerusalem. And so what we see, Jesus, he knew why he was here. He knew that he came to die. This allusion to his death, it passed by so quickly, it's possible that his disciples didn't even notice it. If they were listening, which very likely they did because we have it recorded. So it's possible it just passed by so quickly that they didn't notice it, but it was written down for us so that we can understand that even back then he knew what was going to happen to him. The wedding feast would be done, and the disciples would then be expected to fast. They will fast in that day. They will fast in those days. It's unclear if they would fast twice a week like the Pharisees did at that time. And there's no indication of frequency of their fasting. We do know that they did fast. But in the New Testament, there's no command to fast. Just like there's no real command to fast in the Old Testament except for once a year around the Day of Atonement. So there's no command for us to fast, but we do have not regulations per se, but guidelines, I guess, in terms of what we need to do around fasting. And we do see that in Matthew chapter 6. I got that. Matthew 6, 16 through 18. Don't make a big show of it. When you fast is the phrase that's used there that Jesus has. But at the same time, we see that Paul fasted. We see in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 27, when he is going through his long list of the things that he's done, where he is, all the sufferings that he's gone through as an apostle. One of the like short phrases that you see there, he says, "and fastings often." Of course, just previously, he says he's lacking food and drink, which suggests he's not doing so willingly. And then it says, "and fastings often," which means he's doing so willingly. So we see that he did engage in fasting and did so often. All right. So, comments, questions before we go on to the next illustration? Yes.
I would love to drink water while I'm fasting or no?
I would recommend it. whenever I've done that, I have drunk water. That's the only thing. We see one of the type of fasting that Daniel did. He said, "I will not let anything pleasant pass through my lips." And I think it's in Daniel 10. But he basically says, "I'm going to eat like bread and water, essentially. Have bread and So you really, whenever you're fast, you set the terms of the fast. Especially in the New Testament age where we have no real guidelines except for what Jesus said, don't make a big show of it. So you set the guidelines, the terms of the fast, but you got to stick to it. That's the thing.
A good term that we use for that is self-denial.
Okay.
So you're choosing what you're going to deny yourself. And we can do that in lots of areas of life that have nothing to do with food.
Yeah.
Right? We can decide that we're not going to, you could go on a fast from watching television.
Yeah.
You could do anything. You could say, I'm not going to read. I read lots of books all the time. I read lots of books for pleasure. I'm only going to read scripture for a week. Or whatever. There's this whole general notion of self-denial and focusing on God.
Yeah. Very good point. All right. Any other thoughts? All right. So the next couple of illustrations are, they basically are saying the same thing. You don't put the old with the new, essentially. And it's not, it's some people try to read a little bit too much into this, I think, by saying something about the old covenant with the new covenant. But, I don't think that really fits in this context. We can certainly go to other places for that. 2 Corinthians 3, for instance. But here, we see that he's talking about some common sense things that they had back then. You don't put, basically in this particular passage in verse 21, he's talking about sewing a patch. There's a hole in a garment and you want to patch it up. So what do you do? This is where the picture would come in. I'd show you what it would look like if you put a new patch on an old garment. You've noticed, I'm sure, and some of you who are more familiar with cloth and clothing might be much more familiar with this, but you've noticed, I'm sure, that whenever you go to the store and you try something on and it fits great, and then you go home and wash it, and then it's a little snug. You didn't get fatter in that little bit of time. Probably. You didn't get taller. It's because, it shrunk a little bit. And that's that kind of happens even today with our modern clothes and our modern technology. But back then, of course, that happened quite a bit. They would wash some clothes and it would shrink a little bit. And so when it says unshrunk cloth, he's talking about something new, something that really hasn't been washed yet. And so he's saying, don't, this is a common sense thing. People know about this. particularly back then, where you don't patch up an old piece of cloth, you know, something that has a hole in it, with something that hasn't been unshrunk, something that's new. Because if you do that, you're gonna tie it on there, and then you wash the thing, and the new cloth will shrink and make the tear worse. And again, the picture would be fantastic. I might show it next week. Yes.
Remember, they didn't have polyester.
Yeah.
So, and they didn't have cotton. They had cotton for that matter, but they did have wool, and wool is especially bad at shrinking.
Yeah.
So you know, this was a dramatic illustration. It's like everybody goes like, oh yeah, boy, you would never do that. You know, nobody would say, huh? You know,
yeah.
They'd all go, yep, absolutely. Nobody would do this.
Yeah. You know, and it's inappropriate to do this kind of thing, just as that's inappropriate for the disciples to fast at this happy time. You know, we're trying to keep this in context, relating it back to Jesus' main point. And then he talks about these wineskins. New wine, we might call grape juice. That's what new wine is, not something that has not yet been fermented. And Jesus is actually talking about the process of fermentation. You know, we understand, many of us, that fermentation is a biochemical reaction. So what are some of the things that are required for fermentation?
Yeast.
You said ventilation.
Time.
I've got two things that are pertinent to the discussion. You know, there's lots of things that we could look at. How about an enclosed container?
Yeah, well, kind of. I make a lot of wine, and the container has to be able to, I'm trying to think, like exhale, but you don't want it to inhale.
Okay, all right. Another is it needs room to expand, doesn't it? One of the things I've made, it's a non-alcoholic drink, ginger beer. I've made that time and again in the past. And it's a reaction with yeast and sugar, essentially. And you've got to make it, at least the way I make it. Maybe there are other ways to do it. But you got to put it into a soda bottle, a 2-3 liter soda bottle, and close it up tight. Because those things are designed, those types of bottles are designed to handle the kind of expansion that occurs. It builds up CO2, carbon dioxide, and it pushes and expands, and just like a carbonated beverage almost. In fact, it does carbonate the beverage. So it's an interesting thing that you need that room to expand. I've tried it before in a glass bottle, and it didn't work because there was no room to expand. And the top wasn't tight enough, and so it kind of leaked, and it didn't work. It didn't do like it was meant to. So what you need is room to expand. You need a somewhat enclosed container. What they did back then is they took a goat skin, which is another picture I was going to show. They took a goat skin, that's why they say wine skins, and they skinned the goat completely as one piece. And they would sew up the places where they would tear it up to take it off, and sew up the legs, and that would be the wine, or the wineskin. When you put new wine into a wineskin, it would make the wineskin expand, right? Ancient wineskins, mention that. And they would sew it up to make it appropriate for this kind of fermentation. And the older a skin gets, you might have noticed this on yourself if you've got some little skin flake off, especially if you get sunburn, you know, it doesn't expand as well. Skin is pretty spongy, right? It expands and contracts as it needs to, and you know, it's pretty. But an old skin, a skin that has been, and I mean that by something that has been removed from a body. It's not nearly as spongy as it used to be, and it gets dried out. And so that's a problem that we have here. It's less pliable, and it's less able to accommodate the expansion that comes with fermentation.
Like shedding.
Yeah, like shedding. Whenever you see skin come off in that way. Yeah, that's right.
Snakes do that.
They do. Yeah, we call it molting. That's right. All right, an old wineskin is already stretched to its limit, and it's already been used to ferment wine because it's already been used for that particular purpose. So as a result, the skin will burst if you put in new wine in there for the purpose of fermentation. And your batch is ruined, not to mention your skin or the wineskin. So it is inappropriate to put new wine in old wineskins, just as it is inappropriate for Jesus' disciples to fast at this time. So, we'll take a moment. I've got on here a rabbit to chase, if we had the time, but we don't. Talking about wine in this manner is a curious choice for our Lord. So, I've got some verses up there that talk about wine. So, if you want to write those down, you can look at those up later. And we might be able to discuss it next time. Yes, I'm sorry. If you're sitting there, the podium might be in the way. So if you have a chance later, you can get up and copy them down. So what I would like to do with the little bit of overtime we've got, can you think of any other innocuous but inappropriate things like this that we might be able to relate in our own time? Because not every one of us really is that familiar with fermentation, and not everyone deals with cloth in that manner. So what's a good illustration that we might be able to come up with in our own culture, in our own time? Pardon?
Concrete expands.
Okay.
But the joints in concrete expand.
Okay. So you wouldn't put a slab of concrete without having some joints in there. All right. One thing I was thinking of in terms of this old and new paradigm is you're not going to put Windows 10 on an old computer, on a computer that's 10, 15 years old. You're not going to do that. It's not going to work. and so that's a technology one that many of us will likely understand. So that's one example that I came up with, and I was thinking we might be able to come up with some others. Yes, ma'am.
One thing that we have to be careful of today is our grape juice up here on the table. Already been used, does not go back into the container you took it out of, it goes down the sink, because that will spoil the fresh that's in the refrigerator.
Right. Right, because there's contaminants and it could possibly even ferment it back there. Yeah. 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 All right. And I do mention in my rabbit chase that even in the New Testament, we see that the cup used for the fruit of the for the Lord's Supper is never called wine. It's never called wine in the New Testament. It's called the cup or the fruit of the vine. Wine for them was an ambiguous term. Wine for them could mean alcoholic or non-alcoholic. For us, we think of it as alcoholic. So it's a little less ambiguous for us. So, but even so, Jesus never called it wine. The Bible never calls it wine. Calls it the cup or the fruit of the vine. So even then, they didn't use that ambiguous word. All right. Last thought. The conflict had increased between Jesus and the religious elite of his day. He had forgiven sins as only God can, but proved it with a miracle. He is associated with the outcasts of society, and now he has bucked a tradition of fasting among the devout. Next, we will see him buck the traditions developed around the Sabbath day. All right.